طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we take a long, critical look at the history and role of the Palestinian Authority, the PA, as a militarized security agency working in collaboration with Israel to enforce the occupation and colonization of Palestine. Columbia University professor Joseph Massad, who has done extensive research on the PA, addresses the issue in an Electronic Intifada podcast excerpted for broadcast on This Week in Palestine. Here it is.
Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. My name is Tamara Nassar. I am subbing for my colleague Nora Barris-Friedman, and this is Asa Winstanley. We are delighted to welcome our very special guest today, Joseph Massad. Professor Massad teaches modern Arab politics and intellectual history at Columbia University in New York City. He is the author of several books, including Desiring Arabs and Islam and Liberalism. He is also one of the leading Palestinian intellectuals of our time. Professor Massad, thank you for joining us back on the show.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for joining us. We know you're very busy, and it's a real privilege for us to have you back on the show again.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure, Asa. Thank you.
So the Palestinian Authority has been in the news since the horrific murder of a prominent Palestinian dissident in the custody of its security forces on June 24th earlier this year. And the killing of Banat and the PA's subsequent attacks, arrests, beatings of demonstrators protesting his killing have exposed more than ever the purpose of the PA's existence, fundamentally as Israel's collaborator. So today's discussion will give a brief overview of what these past few months have revealed about the Palestinian Authority and its origins, but it will also give an overview of the position that the PA occupies today. So in a recent Middle East Eye piece in June, you described the Palestinian Authority as a collaborating body with the Israeli apartheid regime under U.S. sponsorship. Could you please start by explaining how the PA acts for Israel and not for the Palestinians?
Well, I've been describing the Palestinian Authority as a collaborating authority ever since its inception back in 1994 when it took over power after the PLO signed the Oslo Agreement in September 1993, around 28 years this week, 28 years ago. So I think, you know, that the PA was created precisely as a collaborating body through the Oslo mechanism. Remember, the Israelis had been always looking, always on the lookout, searching for collaborating Palestinians, and they found a good number since the 1920s. However, they were unable and were unsuccessful in finding Palestinians with much national legitimacy to collaborate with them. Ever since the PLO was created in 1964, and subsequently since 1969, when the guerrilla groups took over the PLO and it began to represent the effort of Palestinians to resist and combat Israeli colonialism, the Israelis began to look very seriously for an alternative to the PLO. This became more pressing in the early to mid-1970s, as the PLO began to get international recognition. In 1973, it received recognition from the non-aligned movement. In 1974, it received it from both the League of Arab States as well as the United Nations. Therefore, the Israelis were most concerned about the ascending international legitimacy of the Palestinian cause as represented by the guerrilla-dominated PLO. They had, they went through a number of strategies, one of which was having mayoral elections in the West Bank and Gaza. Initially successful in 1972, they brought about mayors that were loyalists to the Hashemite regime in Jordan, which had been on very good terms with the Israelis and with the Zionists since the 1920s, and therefore tried to or hoped that they could stand in for Palestinian interests rather than the PLO, especially as their political position would not have been inimical to that of Israel, but rather cooperative. It didn't work. By 1976, the entire slate of mayors that were elected on a PLO platform, and the elections backfired on Israel, who had at the time hoped to project a kind of image of a benign military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. They tried again with the failure of the mayoral and municipal elections. They tried with something they called the Village Leagues in 1978, which also fell through in the early 80s, as most of the participants in the Village League project were immediately identified as collaborators and traitors by the PLO and were threatened if they were to participate in that body. All these attempts had failed, and we can speak perhaps later on the history of earlier attempts to co-opt Palestinian leaders. The Israelis decided in the 1980s they went back to the Jordan option, which had been given up by King Hussein in the middle of the 1970s, not out of his own will, but as a result of the will of the League of Arab States, which chose at the time to recognize the PLO as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinians. Nonetheless, after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the defeat of the PLO and its exile, and certainly after it was fragmented in 1983 through a kind of a civil war between the different factions of the PLO, the Jordanians decided in the middle of the 1980s to perhaps extend a rope to save it from drowning by allowing it to hold a PNC meeting in Amman when other countries in the Arab world had refused. But this was in preparation for some kind of final what was called at the time pragmatic position that the PLO would adopt. Things accelerated quickly. Finally, the Jordan option was no longer available in 1987 with the Palestinian uprising engulfing the occupied territories. The Jordanian regime decided to de-link itself from the West Bank. And the Israelis now were in a bind that the Jordanian regime, which had historically spoken for the Palestinians, were now delinking. The saving grace of this entire story was, of course, the Gulf War and the penalties that accumulated against the PLO as a result in terms of funding by Gulf governments, which stopped. Iraq stopped funding because it was now under siege. This was coupled with a major failure internationally in terms of its diplomatic stature with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. So the PLO was finally exactly where Israel had always hoped hoped it would be. Without funds, without diplomatic backing, it could now bend in any possible way that the Israelis would want it to. And indeed, it did. So this is the time when, even though in 91 they were not really sure, and they still brought in the Jordanians to speak for the Palestinians at the Madrid conference. I mean, they brought in a Palestinian delegation under the rubric of the Jordanian delegation, but secretly they were basically hammering out a deal to make sure the PLO surrendered completely on all the principles for which it had stood since the middle of the 1960s and certainly since 1969, which it obliged at Oslo. So the PLO in that sense was transformed through the mechanism of Oslo from the liberation movement to a movement or an organization that would help enforce the occupation, that with which the Israelis in a way subcontracted a Jewish settler colonialism in the occupied territories. This was very important, of course, for the Israelis, a great achievement, because the PLO had a huge amount of legitimacy prior to 1993 as a representative of the Palestinians. And therefore, rather than find a counter organization to the PLO, which they had tried to do, which always lacked that kind of legitimacy, they hoped, and perhaps correctly to a certain extent, that the legitimacy of the period of struggle that the PLO had acquired would sort of have a large momentum that would carry it through its collaborationist future in a way. And to a certain extent, that's exactly sort of how things unfolded. But very, very quickly, of course, the PLO gave way to the Palestinian Authority, which Oslo insisted on it as a body to be created and to be the future negotiator with Israel on whatever deal they would broker. The PLO, as a representative of all Palestinians, was relegated to the background. The PA came to speak for the Palestinians of the occupied territories minus East Jerusalem, of course, not the diaspora, not the refugees, and certainly not Palestinians inside Israel. So in one stroke, not only did the PLO become a collaborating body, it ceased to, in doing so, it contracted the Palestinian people by two-thirds, meaning it gave up its representative capacity for all Palestinians and claimed now, as Israel had been doing for decades, that the Palestinian people are only those who live in the West Bank and Gaza, and therefore they're the only ones that Israel would be concerned with in terms of any possible deal in the future. The budget and the money that used to go into the coffers of the PLO were now dry and they were transferred to the PA. So as a result, definitionally, the Palestinian Authority was created as a collaborationist body to help enforce the occupation. It was created through the Cairo Agreement, or rather, its police force was created through the Cairo Agreement, and the responsibilities for its police force was precisely to safeguard Jewish colonial settlers in the occupied territories in Gaza and the West Bank, and to prevent all acts of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli occupation, and most importantly, to demobilize Palestinian society, which had been highly mobilized since December 1987 after the eruption of the Palestinian revolt known as the First Intifada. So it quickly moved to perform all these tasks with aplomb, I would say.
So you've talked a little bit there about earlier in what you were saying about the village leagues, the failure of the village leagues as a kind of precursor in a way to the Palestinian Authority as a collaborationist entity in the West Bank. Could you talk about earlier efforts by Israel and the Zionist movement before 1948 to recruit Palestinian collaborators?
Indeed. I think, you know, the effort was really an important one, and it begins as soon as the British occupation of Palestine begins in December, late November, early December 1917. By August 1918, much of mandate Palestine was under British occupation. The Zionist executive, which was set up to represent the colonial settler Jewish population in Palestine, began to pay closer attention to the question of co-opting Palestinian leaders or Palestinians whom the Zionists would make into leaders to speak for the Palestinians. One of the important responses that Palestinians had after the British occupation, and they continued their ongoing resistance to Jewish settler colonialism that had begun in the 1880s, was the creation of Muslim-Christian associations. They had to do this because the British set up a sectarian system as soon as they came in. They insisted on Palestine being divided among its different religious sects, meaning Muslims, Christians, and Jews. There was a very tiny community of Jews who had been in Palestine since the 16th century. They numbered about 4,000 in the middle of the 19th century. There were probably about 10,000 at that time. But there was, of course, a growing body of Jewish colonial settlers who now seem to have amalgamated, according to the British, in Palestinian society, that they constituted a separate, almost indigenous sect rather than a colonial settler sect. In that sense, what the British were doing in Palestine in the early 20s is not unlike what the Americans tried to do in Iraq after the occupation, of segmenting it along ethnic or religious lines. However, Sunni in doing Shia, so, Sunni, Shia, and it's more complicated in Iraq because they did it religiously in terms of Sunni and Shia, and then they did the Kurdish versus Arab, although it was just like there's Kurdish parties and the Arabs were divided into Sunni and Shiites. This way, the Iraqi people now became three different segments in the name of American-style democracy, if you will. So the British had done something very similar. To counter that, early on, Palestinian Muslims and Christians immediately set up a Muslim-Christian associations, first of all, to gain legitimacy in the new sectarian system that the British had established, and at the same time to show unity of purpose and of political goals in fighting the Balfour Declaration, British occupation, as well as the facilitation of Jewish settler colonialism, which the British occupation and mandate promised to sponsor, and were indeed already sponsoring. So as a result, the Zionist executive was very concerned about this solidarity among Palestinian Christians and Muslims and began to work to undermine this show of communal solidarity among Palestinian Christians and Muslims. So they began to sponsor and finance Muslim national associations that excluded Christians with local collaborators. This would become a very important effort. It would be they would choose several Palestinians to collaborate with them on the Muslim national associations. And one of them, of course, was a collaborator, a Palestinian mayor of Haifa by the name of Hassan Shukri, who was already in office since 1914 by the Ottomans, and who in 1921 thanked the British in a letter for issuing the Balfour Declaration and continued to collaborate with them until his death in 1940. There were several assassination attempts on him in the 1930s that were unsuccessful. He died of natural causes in 1940 and remains a hero collaborator for Zionism and Israel, who continue to celebrate them to this day. So there were others, of course, who were involved in this project. The Chaim Kalvariski, one of the most important Zionist colonial officials, who was also in charge of the so-called Arab department in the Zionist executive that represented the colonial settler community in Palestine, was the one in charge of co-opting Palestinians to put them on the pay, on the payroll of the Zionist executive, and to advance the agenda of Zionism, that Zionism was not a threat to the Palestinians at all, that they would improve Palestinian lives, and that they should be viewed as friends and not as colonial conquerors, for example. Someone like Hassan Shukri would later insist on adding Hebrew to official bureaucratic paperwork in the Haifa municipality municipality in the 1930s, despite the fact that the Arabic was always the official language and all the native population of Haifa spoke Arabic as their native language, regardless of if they were Jewish, even the small Jewish community who spoke Arabic versus the colonial settlers, of course, who did not. So that's one aspect of this. They even set up with the help of a major Jerusalemite family, the Nashashibi family or its leaders, who were in opposition to another Palestinian Jerusalem family that the British also appointed to high office. They played both families against one another, but the Nashashibis would not only collaborate with the British, but especially with the Zionists, even in creating what was called then peasant parties or sometimes farmer parties that allegedly were organized by the Zionists against Palestinian landlords, although, of course, it was Palestinian big landlords who set them up as a front for Zionist interest. They were small. They did not have much following. It's not unlike what you have in all other colonial situations where the colonizing power sets up bodies of collaborators and tries to infiltrate all resistance against the colonial project. So the Muslim National Associations were, of course, meant to alienate Palestinian Christians, that Muslims were having their own associations. And slowly the British would only recognize a lot of these religious organizations separately. They would set up something called the Supreme Islamic Council for Palestinian Muslims. Palestinian Christians divided into a number of denominations, the largest of which, of course, is the Eastern Orthodox Palestinian Christians, set up their own organizations that were in alliance with the Muslim organizations, but now were separate because the British demanded that even municipal elections be divided along sectarian lines. So the kind of sectarianism that the British and the Zionists introduced into Palestine was the main venue through which they had hoped collaboration with the colonizers would be most effective. To a certain extent, they did create some sectarian divisions in the late 1920s and early 1930s, especially as the British would allow a major evangelical Protestant conference to take place in Jerusalem at that time, sponsored mostly by the British founded YMCA, but sponsored by its American branches at the time, in the hope of sort of making Jerusalem a center for evangelical Christianity. Most Palestinian Christians, especially the Orthodox, whose laity had been targeted by Protestant evangelicals to be converted to their religion, immediately opposed the conference, as did other Muslims. But of course, there was all kinds of sectarian propaganda put forth that the evangelicals might have been supported by Palestinian Christians, which of course they were not. And indeed, all the major bodies of Palestinian, representative bodies of Palestinian Muslims and Christians came together to condemn the conference and condemn the sectarian sort of campaign that ensued. After the Palestinian revolt began initially in 1935, with the guerrilla groups under Izzeddin al-Qassam, and subsequently when the strike began in 1936, with the revolt becoming increasingly widespread across the country and British repression becoming more and more draconian, the British and the Zionists were able to fund and train a number of Palestinian collaborators, some of whom had been actually part of the Palestinian revolt, but were co-opted by the British representative in Damascus at the time, sent back to Palestine to lead what was then called the peace bands, or what Palestinian nationalists would refer to as the peace gangs, who began to target the Palestinian revolutionaries and shoot them. And they were, of course, on the payroll of the Zionists, and the British had helped train them. Ultimately, two of the major leaders of the peace bands, Fakhri Nashashibi and Fakhri Abdulhadi, would be assassinated in 1941 and 1943 by Palestinian loyalists for their collaboration. They did not, of course, command a large following, but they clearly were able to inflict some harm on the Palestinian revolution. After 1948, Palestinians living inside Israel were subjected, those who were not expelled, the remaining Palestinians who were managed to not to be expelled inside Israel. Also, their leaders were being co-opted, especially village mukhtars, or the village elders, mayors, who through whom the Israelis tried to impose their apartheid policies, the pass laws that they imposed on Palestinian citizens of Israel from 1948 to 1966. Which was extended actually to 67 before it was finally removed. All of that happened through the Mukhtars and some other sort of collaborating Palestinians, and which takes us to the occupied territories after 1967, where, as I mentioned earlier, the municipal elections would be the sort of major venue of the early 70s, moving to the Village League in the late 70s. So the Israelis had, or the Zionists had, never tired of finding Palestinians who would collaborate with them. The problem with all these attempts, as I was saying earlier, is that few of these collaborators had ever had any legitimacy in the eyes of the majority of the Palestinian people. And no national representative body ever collaborated in this sense, or the Israelis were unable to co-opt them until they co-opted the PLO and transformed it into the PA in the early 1990s.
So those first years when the Palestinian Authority was founded out of a transition from the Palestine Liberation Organization, what did they look like on the ground? And can you think of other comparable examples in history of a liberation movement going over to the side of oppressor?
Well, I mean, at the beginning of the PA rule or Oslo, like I said earlier, the Cairo agreement and subsequently the Washington signing of it or ratification of it created the bodies of Palestinian security core that would be used to repress the Palestinians and to prevent any resistance to them. I've written several times on the earliest of incidents when three Fatah militias shot this guy who refused to remove his car after he parked it in a place where they did not like in Gaza. They shot him in the legs. A few weeks later, when Arafat arrived in Gaza and there was demonstrations by students against Oslo, his police force killed between 13 or 14 Palestinian students, something which for which he was commended by then Vice President Al Gore, who was happy with Arafat setting up military tribunals for those who opposed Oslo, which of course were depicted as terrorists or extremists who are anti-peace rather than anti-collaboration and anti-surrender. That security body that was, of course, subsequently trained by the Americans and funded by the Americans and the EU over the years, initially it began as its mandate was its responsibility for internal security and for public order, meaning to prevent Palestinian resistance and to also protect Jewish colonial settlers, not in their settlements because they could not go there, but if they decide to go through Palestinian towns, whether shopping or to harass the indigenous Palestinians. So initially there was about 9,000 policemen, 7,000 of whom were brought in with the PLO from abroad, from exile. So these were clearly Palestinian guerrillas who were transformed through the mechanism of Oslo into mercenaries, right? This would be the birth certificate of the Palestinian security force. But with regards to the question of precedence in other places, I mean, I think there's probably one prominent precedent, which is UNITA, which was one of the liberation movements in Angola. It was one of two major liberation movements. There was the MPLA and UNITA. UNITA had been funded and supported by the Chinese from the middle of the 1960s or late 60s up to 1975 or 76. Upon the liberation of Angola, UNITA switched sides rather than from fighting the Portuguese for the liberation of Angola, as the MPLA took over the country after independence. UNITA began to receive funding and training by apartheid South Africa and the US to undermine the revolution and the new independent country of Angola, and in that sense began to, when not only began, launched an actual war and raids on Angola with South Africa's apartheid backing at the time. So, you know, and of course, Angola was a settler colony as well. Most of the Portuguese settler colonists left after the end of Portuguese settler colonialism, but there had always been interest in Angola by South Africa, who had already been in occupation of Namibia, which was another white colonial settlement bordering Angola. So in that sense, perhaps not as egregious as what the PLO did. But remember, most national, or not most, a large number of liberation groups who after, you know, after they won independence in normal colonies, not in settler colonies, would come to serve as allies of the former colonial power after they come to, after they come to power. The Neo-Destour of Tunisia, for example, which would become, of course, an ally of France. And there are many, many examples. And Tunisia also had been a French settler colony, not as large as France, not as large as the Italian settler colony of Libya, but nonetheless a settler colony. And but you still saw this kind of collaboration by kind of a nationalist movement that was not committed necessarily to a revolutionary program, but rather to more of a garden variety titular national independence from formal colonialism rather than any kind of economic independence, which it did not call for.
I want to bring it up to the present day a little bit and how the Palestinian Authority is perceived in the West. And by that, I don't mean so much the Western governments, but I actually mean even the Palestine Solidarity Movement in Europe and North America. So why do some people in the Palestine Solidarity Movement view the PA as, quote unquote, the government of Palestine? I can give one example of this recently that happened in Britain, which was there was a solidarity event called the Big Ride for Palestine, which was a kind of sponsored bike ride to raise funds. It was organized by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. But at its final rally, it hosted the PA's London ambassador, Hassan Zomlot, as its star speaker. So, you know, and it's just one of many examples. Hassan Zomlot often attends Palestine solidarity demonstrations in London and so forth. And his predecessor was the same. And he was welcomed by the PA, but by the PSC. So, I mean, one comparison people often make of the PA in terms of the South Africa example would be the Bantustans, the sort of collaborationist entities under the South African apartheid regime. So there's some similarities there with the PA. But you can't imagine the anti-apartheid movement in the 70s or 80s welcoming Bantustan leaders to London. So, like, why do you think the true nature of the PA is not more widely understood in these areas? And why is it not viewed in a similar way to the Bantustan leaders?
Well, I mean, several things. Remember that the PLO, again, this was the reason why the Israelis thought the best thing to do, instead of finding an anti-PLO Palestinian collaborating leadership, why not transform the PLO itself into an anti-PLO collaborations leadership? Because this way we could bank on its historic legitimacy. And indeed, remember, the PLO in the 60s and 70s and 80s was seen as not unlike all these other liberation movements from settler colonialism, whether it's the ANC, whether it was SWAPO in Namibia, Frelimo in Mozambique, the MPLA in Angola, etc. So it was seen as, or you know, ZANU and ZAPU in Rhodesia. So the there's a great sort of reputation that these revolutionary groups had because of the struggle that they had engaged in to liberate their peoples from settler colonialism. This was a, you know, this was part of the big reputation that the PLO had. Subsequently, after Oslo, the liberal propaganda insisted that what the PLO had done was basically a peace deal with Israel, wherein allegedly we were told there was mutual recognition. Of course, there was no such thing at Oslo. At Oslo, the PLO recognized Israel's right to exist as a Jewish settler colony on the land of the Palestinians. In return, the Israelis only recognized the PLO as the legitimate representative of the Palestinians. People. They did not recognize the Palestinian people's right to their homeland or a state or anything of the sort. So it was not really mutual recognition. But US and European propaganda, as well as Arab official regime propaganda, began to put forth this idea that the PLO had not really changed. It was the same PLO and not a different one. People would begin to wake up to this perhaps after 2006 with Hamas elections that defeated Fatah, but by then Islamophobia had been institutionalized much more so than ever before after 9/11, and therefore the PLO or the PA maintained that it was still the legitimate Palestinian representative. The difference between the Bantustans and the ANC versus the PLO is that when the Bantustans existed, when the Inkatha movement or people like Buthelezi were collaborating with apartheid South Africa, they were countered by the ANC, by Oliver Tambo, by Nelson Mandela's reputation, even when he was imprisoned, which is exactly what happened when the village leagues were put about. The PLO was there to counter the village leagues. The PLO was there to counter the sort of pro-Hashemite mayors of the early 70s who had been elected in 1972. And therefore, this undermined them. But by the time the PLO itself became the Inkatha sort of movement, if you will, or maybe to be more precise, when Arafat was transformed from Nelson Mandela into a Buthelezi, there was no counter to him. So as a result, it gave legitimacy to the Bantustan project. Imagine if Nelson Mandela was the one who would agree to have presided over something like the Bantustans.
Right.
There was a lot of that, I think, that went into people's perceptions of what the PA was. There was a lot less room for the Palestinian opposition to Oslo to be broadcast in the international Western-dominated media. Perhaps there was a lot more of that in the Arab media, but less so in the international media. I remember my first article against Oslo was in an academic journal, not in a journalistic mode, which I submitted, say, in October of 1993. It came out in early 94 because it was a journal. It took more time to be published. But it would have been very, very difficult for me to have found newspaper outlets where I could express these views in the sort of radical rejection of the premise of Oslo, which my article at the time had expressed. Similarly, when Edward Said opposed Oslo immediately after the deal, the only place that would publish his rejection was a kind of a liberal Zionist newspaper where he had published before, which is The Nation magazine in London, but in New York. But he was also publishing in the Arabic press in London and in the Egyptian Al-Ahram Weekly, where he expressed also his views on these questions. And indeed, most of his articles that were critical of the Palestinians, if you want the long version, you should read them in Al-Ahram Weekly or in Al-Hayat in Arabic, and the much more highly perhaps censored and shortened version would come out in The Nation magazine at that time. And I'm not really sure how many of his articles they might have rejected and how many they accepted, but that was the only venue, as I recall, where he published his early criticisms
The Palestinian Versailles, he called it, right?
The Palestinian Versailles, yes. I actually was critical of that analogy in writing when I wrote, and I discussed this with Saeed at the time, because I thought that Versailles was imposed on a Germany that began the war. The Palestinians never began the war. So, yes, the effect of the humiliation of Germany after the war through Versailles might have been similar to the humiliation of the Palestinians. But of course, a more apt analogy I always thought was the kinds of deals that were imposed on the ruler of Tunisia by France in the 1880s to welcome French occupation into his country, as a more appropriate example, or the pressure on Egypt and the co-optation of the rulers of Egypt in the early 1880s, and which facilitated the British invasion and occupation of Egypt, ultimately while maintaining its rulers in titular power. So I thought there were colonial precedents that could have been access that were perhaps more akin to what happened to the Palestinians than Versailles. Although, of course, Saeed's sentiment was correct in the sense that Versailles was an attempt to fully humiliate the Palestinians, right? Of course, the nation liked that analogy of Versailles. They would repeat it several times. And I thought, of course, they had an ulterior motive, because usually what Versailles always meant was that the humiliation of Versailles is what gave ammunition to the Nazis to rise. So the idea was that the nation editors were always concerned about the Palestinians becoming Nazi rather than about the continued colonization by Zionist settler colonialism of Palestinian land. So I was always not very positive about the use of the Versailles analogy.
Interesting.
So shifting gears a little bit, but why do you think the Palestinian Authority has been so enduring, almost 30 years since its inception? The recent protests against the PA in the wake of the killing of Mizar Banat, and recent polls as well, show that there is a profound rejection of the PA and its leader, Mahmoud Abbas, in the West Bank. Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza view the PA security thugs as spies, as collaborators. But at the same time, the Palestinian Authority persists in its role in collaborating with Israel, in its security forces acting as Israel's foot soldiers. And both the PA and its ruling party, Fatah, provide some kind of or have some kind of base amongst some Palestinians in the West Bank. When you compare this to the village leagues, there is some kind of persistence to the PA that would be interesting to examine. Why do you think it has endured so long?
As I just mentioned, the village leagues was countered by the presence of the PLO. And it was created in the late 70s, early 80s, before the entrenchment of neoliberalism and the end of the Cold War. So the international context, the economic context within which it existed, did not allow for its continuation in an easy fashion. And the presence of the PLO and its strong international legitimacy at the time was a major obstacle that could not be overcome. And the creation of the PA in the 90s, after the fall of the Soviet Union, with the U.S. Being the sole superpower controlling the world, was a much easier transformation in terms of institutionalizing the interests of the PA. Remember, one of the important things that Oslo did was institutionalize the PA financially in the lives of the Palestinians. First of all, it demobilized the Palestinian revolution, the first Intifada, by co-opting many of its leaders into the PA political class or bureaucracy or the security apparatus, and it co-opted all the technicians and the intellectuals into the mushrooming non-governmental organizations who had descended like the plague on the Palestinian territories, offering relatively very, very high incomes to activists
The NGO industrial complex.
Absolutely. It is the NGO industrial complex. So as a result, you've created a population under occupation who is now fully dependent financially on income that comes to it from the peace process. The NGOs were created by the peace process. They were linked to it. The PA was created by the peace process. It was linked to it. The financial remuneration and financial aid that went into the PA coffers went into it as long as there was a peace process that was unfolding and ongoing. And therefore, now you've attached the majority of the Palestinian population, whose economic situation was dire at the end of 6 years or 5 years of the first Intifada and the destruction of much of the Palestinian, especially agricultural economy, but much of the economy in general. So this situation to rescue the Palestinians economically through employment by the PA and by the NGOs would link, I think, the Palestinians structurally and economically to the PA and the peace process. As a result, anyone who wanted to oppose the PA or to bring it down would lose their job and their livelihood. This way, you linked the livelihoods of people to their oppression, to their national oppression, and to the possibility of the continuation of their colonization by Jewish settler colonists. One of the interesting things that the Oslo had done, having come about after the 1980s, after the fall of the Soviet Union, after the institutionalization and the expansion of neoliberalism, is the creation of a number of classes. Oslo created a number of classes to help institutionalize the PA as a permanent fixture. So there was what you had is basically a political elite that was created or brought from exile to staff the Palestinian Authority, but also some of the political elites inside the West Bank and Gaza were also added to those who arrived from Tunisia. A second group was the bureaucracy that was needed to administer the population for the PA, composed mostly of local staff, but also of returnees that also used to staff the different PLO departments. A third segment was, of course, the security force, which was used to repress Palestinian resistance to Israel and to Oslo, as it continues today, composed of former guerrillas turned mercenaries for Israel to be financed and trained by the Americans and the Europeans, employees of the non-governmental organizations, which, as I've mentioned, are most of the intellectual and technocratic class. They were all set up by the Americans and the Europeans, some by the Japanese, mostly former activists and public intellectuals who participated in the first Intifada would become part of the new NGO staffs. And then, of course, you have the Palestinian business class, the local and the diaspora class, who returned from exile to profit off their people and off the Oslo process, and those sort of and the rich already in the West Bank and Gaza who had been already profiting under the occupation before Oslo would become a very important segment, which in fact, remember, Palestinian millionaires pushed Arafat to sign Oslo, even if he had any doubts, which I'm not sure he did. But they pushed him to accept the deal because of how much benefit they saw in it for Palestinian businesses. So in this sense, as the Oslo Accords were signed at the height of the hegemony of international neoliberal, the international neoliberal order, the purpose, I think, of facilitating profit-making for Palestinian businessmen, there was a number of programs to empower Palestinian women to become entrepreneurs, but they remain small. But also sort of the linking of the Palestinian intelligentsia to the NGOs, all of that was able to ensure a relatively lean administrative staff inside the PA and an expansive security apparatus to repress resistance. Just to give you an example, a couple of years ago, amidst the preparations for the Deal of the Centuries Bahrain conference, which Jared Kushner had presided over on the orders of Trump, as they were preparing for this conference in Bahrain, the Israeli Army Chief of General Staff, General Aviv Kochavi, had met with a prominent Palestinian millionaire in Ramallah to discuss the current economic situation in the West Bank. So we're speaking here about direct meetings between Palestinian businessmen and the Israeli military brass, not even the political brass, to discuss the economic situations and the profit-making operations that the Palestinian bourgeoisie has benefited and continues to benefit from. So in this sense, by the time Trump came and insisted that perhaps the PA's political class may no longer be necessary, all we need is the businessman and the policeman, which is, of course, the same structure for neoliberalism everywhere in the world. The idea of having a lean government, because, you know, the businessmen will be able to run things and those who oppose them will be shot by the police, hence the militarization of the police force in the US and in Europe, and the carte blanche given to business elites to run the affairs of the economy through a very friendly but lean bureaucratic staff that opposes the idea of big government, as they call it in the U.S.
You have been listening to Columbia University Professor Joseph Massad speaking originally on an Electronic Intifada podcast. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.